Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at NewBalance.com.
All right, welcome to the Tennis.com podcast. I am your host, Nina Pantic, and Irina Falcone is missing this episode, but we have an amazing guest, Donald Dell. Donald, welcome.
Welcome. Fun to be here today.
So for those that might not know, and I can't believe they wouldn't know who you are, I'm going to go through a little brief rundown of things that you've been doing for tennis. You went to college at Yale. You're one of Yale's greatest players ever. Law degree from UVA. You had a pro career. You reached number 5 in the world in 1961. Then you became a sports agent, one of the first sports agents in pro tennis, known as the father of sports marketing, alongside IMG's Mark McCormack. Not sure if you're going to argue with that fact, but we'll figure it out. You had a Davis Cup career. You were on the captain for the winning teams, 1968, 1969, founder of Pro Serve, 2 books, Never Make the First Offer, and Minding Other People's Business. This is just a brief look at who our guest is, someone who, in my opinion, is an icon in tennis. So, Donald, I want to say that I'm excited. And one of the first things I want to talk about is this story you wrote for the Washington Post titled Tennis Needs a Central Governing Body That Unites the Men's and Women's Tours. Given your incredible resume, you're more than qualified to sound off. So why does tennis need a merger and why right now?
Well, I think 2 things. One, the reason I say now, Nina, is that everybody has a lot of time. There's no circuit. Nobody's playing. They're practicing. There's some pickup exhibitions on television. But everybody's got time to think about it. And that's a good opportunity to review where we are. The WTA and the ATP, I helped found the ATP in 1972 with Jack Kramer. But it was a players-only union in those days. Today, in 1989, it switched from a players only and became a partnership with the tournaments. So it's now called the ATP Tour Board, and the players have their own division of that partnership, and the tournaments have their own division. But the partnership, has had problems working smoothly over the last, say, 20 years, because tournaments basically, the interest is a partnership, but the interest of the two groups are quite divergent. For example, players want fewer tournaments and more prize money and more money at bigger events. The tournaments, on the other hand, want, better players and less prize money. So there's a lot of push and pull between the two. And what's happened recently in the last 6 or 8 years is you've got to understand the players are 3 votes on the tour board, and the tournaments are 3 votes, and the chairman is the casting vote, 7. But more and more over the last 2 cycles of 3-year terms, the players have voted in a block and the tournaments have voted in a block. So it ends up being a 3-3 standoff. And as a result, the chairman, the last 2 chairmen have come in and cast, the deciding vote several times. And because of that, once it was on prize money, another time it was on scheduling, and the players didn't like what the guy voted in, and both chairmen were removed, were terminated, and lost their jobs over a critical casting vote. So to my way of thinking, the game is global. It's an individual sport. It's not a team sport. So you're playing the same way in Australia or India or Washington, D.C., all the same rules, all the same individual, problems and challenges as an individual player. So in my opinion, we should try to merge with the women. It would strengthen the sport. You got to understand where my goal is. My objective is, how do you make tennis a bigger sport, both globally, but more importantly in America? And so if you start with that premise, if you look at it for a moment, tennis being global is number 2 or 3 in every European or Asian country on television. It's 2 or 3. 1 is always soccer. In some places, basketball is growing like crazy. And tennis has always been number 2 or 3 on media. In America, on media, it's number 11 or 12, take your pick. And that's always troubled me and bothered me. So my objective is, how do you build a bigger sport and a better sport? And television is always the key to that. If you could combine the women with the men in one group, you would have a much stronger organization. However, because of the present conflict, where 3-3 votes lead to a casting vote, which the chairman never wants to make because he fears for his job, I think you should have a commissioner's office, but it's the office, and it ought to be three of them, three different people, one from the players that they select, one from the tournaments they select, and one from the four Grand Slams. So you have three different representatives of a combined group. It could be men or women in the office. But you have three different offices around the world, one in Asia, one in Europe, and one in America, if you really want to make it a world global sport. Now, that sounds very complicated, and it may be very hard to do because you want to pick objective people. Right now, right or wrong, everybody sitting on the ATP Tour Board has an inherent terrible conflict of interest. The tournaments are all there representing tournaments. They all have an interest to protect themselves. The players are representing a group of players on the council. They want to represent and do the best, or they get fired by their council and they're not renewed. So how do you get a really impartial, objective group? And I think one way to do that is to merge the two and then pick your delegates very, very selectively. And they could be on for 5-year terms with an option to terminate or renew. I'd like to build longevity into the program, and I'd like to build longevity and objectivity. And if you had that and you made it global rather than just really in America, what we're talking about, ATP is global, the WTA is more and more global, you'd have a bigger sport and you'd have a better, more exciting sport with instant decisions being made and fair and objective decisions. And I think that would all lead to a better, broader telecast.
Realistically, though, what would the time frame be for something like this to come together? As someone who's seen the founding of the ATP Tour, when someone says, you know what, let's try and do a merger like this, realistically, what would a time frame look like? At 5 years?
Come down to the six people on there. If they really, if players together with tournaments really wanted to build a broader base of objectivity and a broader base of management and governance, they could do it, but it would certainly take a year or two, because first step, you've got to get the men to agree to have the women combined in one uniform, integrated body. And many of the players on the tour today, they don't want to say it publicly, but they fight men and women co-ed tournaments, for example. We had a huge battle to get the women in Washington and the Tennis Channel, actually, and Ken Solomon. They were big leaders in getting that done. Ken is a big advocate, as you probably know, of women's tennis. And we started a tournament in Washington with men for 40 years called the City Open. And then suddenly, when City became the new title sponsor of both, they said, we want a women's event. 51% of our clients are women. And we'll come in and sponsor, for a lot of money, a title sponsor for both events if you ensure that we have a women's tournament. So about 9 years ago, we added women. And because of the calendar, we could only add sort of a mediocre $250,000 women's event, not a $700,000, which we compete against one in the San Francisco, Stanford area that competes with us. But we found very quickly, and really a little bit to my surprise, the women became a tremendous drawing card. And people in Washington who have been going to a men's only tournament for 40 years were very adamant about keeping the women, growing the women, building the women. And of course, our biggest problem with that was the ATP men. They wanted priority on the courts, on scheduling, on prize money. And they said, look, we built the event up for 40 years. You know, they can't just come in and ride on our backs. And I said, well, let's integrate it in a positive way. So every year we chip away at the problem. But it's not something that the body of the ATP is saying, we want and need a women's event. They don't. And yet, if you looked around the world, the most successful tournaments in all of all tournament play professionally our integrated men and women events.
It sounds like a merger would kind of help fight for the battle of equality that the women's tennis and women's sports have been fighting for. But I also want to ask you, what is the status of the 2020 City Open? I don't know how much you know or how much anyone knows. What's your take?
I think it's probably about 2080 that the tournament will be held this year, because ironically, it is the first date that is still open. They haven't made a decision whether or not to cancel. They've canceled Atlanta, which is the week before, and they've canceled Winston-Salem, which is the small tournament right before the U.S. Open. The U.S. Open is trying like crazy. It's probably 50-50. They're trying every way to find a way to continue. I believe that, that what will happen is they'll probably start in either Toronto or Cincinnati if there's any men's play leading into the U.S. Open. The problem with the U.S. Open or the whole American season, you got to bring all the players over from Europe. I mean, the men's players dominate in men's tennis. The women's players, the Americans, are very strong in women's tennis, which is another reason why I think the WTA will get stronger and stronger. Because let's face it, in a global sport, you have to have an American market if you want to be successful on television and in sponsorship and media.
Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at NewBalance.com.
Hey everyone, you're listening to the Tennis.com podcast with special guest Donald Dell. He is touted as the first sports agent in pro tennis and the father of sports marketing, with so many stories to share. Keep listening. But you've seen a lot of not easy things get done in the past, and I want to pivot a little bit here to your Davis Cup captain years. In the 1960s, you led the U.S. team to two titles. A certain player on that team was called Arthur Ashe. What is your first memory of your interaction with Arthur Ashe?
When I retired in 66, I went to work for the law firm. And then in 68, I had played Davis Cup as a player five times for America, with different teams in America. And I played in India, I played in Italy, I played in Mexico, I played in Canada. I mean, I played four or five ties. And one of the captains when I played in 65 was Bob Kelleher, who also was the president of the USTA. And when he became president in 68, one of the first things he did was he asked me to be the Davis Cup captain, which was a shock because I was 29 years old. I was in a law firm, and I was really the youngest captain they'd ever selected. So I went to Arthur Ashe and Charlie Pasquill. Charlie Pasquill, 67, was ranked one in America ahead of Arthur. And they were great friends. And I said, look, I'm happy doing what I'm doing. I'm now working. I left the law firm. In 68, I was now working with Sergeant Shriver at the Office of Economic Opportunity, and he was, you know, the chairman and executive director of it, and I loved politics. I was very involved in 68. I said, I don't want to give the job if you guys are not serious. We hadn't won the Davis Cup in five times. We lost to bad teams, Peru, Ecuador. You know, we lost to a lot of bad teams. And I said, well, I'll do it. I'll take the job, but I got to quit my job. And I really don't want to do that unless you all are committed. And Charlie Pasquill was a tremendous push in getting me to take the job, and Arthur to a lesser extent. I didn't know Arthur as well. And so between the two of them, they said, yes, they would commit. And we got a very good team. There were two young kids coming out of SC named Bobby Lutz and Stan Smith, who were like 5 or 6 years younger than Arthur and Charlie. They were at that time 19 years old, and they were one heck of a doubles team. And Stan Smith grew into being, you know, number one in the world 4 years later in 72 when he won Wimbledon. So we had a tremendous group of people and a tremendous group of players. And I got to know Arthur very, very well for, you know, traveling. I wasn't married. I was single, so that I traveled with the team. And in 68, we had to win six matches around the world to get to the challenge round. Then we beat the Australians down in Adelaide, Australia. We beat Harry Hopman, who was the great Australian captain. This was his last match. He retired, and we beat him down there 4-1, and then came back. And in 69, it was the challenge round format, which is all the tournaments play, and the winner holds and waits till you get to the final and plays the best team in the world in the final, sort of like America's Cup. So in 69, we didn't have to play six. We had to wait. And we played the Romanians with Tiriac and Nastasi in the finals in Cleveland. And they were a heck of a good team, but we were a good team too. And we beat them 5-0. And at that time, the sport went open in 1968. Pro tennis was coming in because Wimbledon and the USTA demanded it. They were going to force the ITF, who had voted against it, to go to open tennis. So in 68, those two were the only open events, Wimbledon and the U.S. Open. And then 69, other tournaments were coming together. And I was the captain of the team with the best six or eight players on the squad. So I decided in early in the summer of 69, I was going to force the issue with the tournaments on the American circuit. And I said, well, we're not coming. And furthermore, we're not going to come to any of the summer tournaments without prize money. This was a big new issue. And Bob Keller, who was then the president of the USTA, who had appointed me Davis Cup captain, and he called me up. He said, Donald, when you were captain a year ago, we made a deal that you could run the team 100% without any interference by the USTA. And as the president, I would handle the politics internally with the association. You remember that? I said, yeah. He said, well, you're now threatening all the tournaments that you won't play with an America's best team unless they put a prize money. And I said, Bob, you led the charge for U.S. Open tennis to become professional. I don't want the American circuit to continue this joke of paying high-paid expenses to amateur players. I want it to be professional. And he said, well, what's your objective? I said, my objective is very simple. I want a tennis player, when someone says, what do you do besides play tennis, which is what they ask me every time, I want them to say, I'm a professional tennis player, just like I'm a professional golfer. That was my objective. And that's what we, and Ash and Pastorell, Bobby Lutz, Stan Smith, Clark Raymer, Jimmy Osborne, we had Cliff Ritchie. We had about eight players on the squad. I picked four for each match. They all agreed with me. They wanted money as well. That forced the American circuit to go to prize money events in 1969. And that really led by the U.S. Open. And the six summer tournaments all put up $25,000 the first year. Then the game changed when the U.S. Open moved to Flushing Meadows and it went to cement. Because then all these grass court tournaments kind of died out as people put on cement courts to be similar. Like Washington, we didn't have grass to start with. We had clay, dirty clay at a public park. We then turned it into a cement courts here now. And so the whole game went from grass to clay for a couple of years when the Open was on clay, and then it all moved to cement when they moved to Flushing Meadows and changed the surface. And that's history.
That is history. That is quite a saga. But it sounds like you were making deals and negotiations in the 60s before you even got into becoming an agent. Is it because it was a natural role for you? Because you have a law degree, you mentioned, that you picked up while playing tennis, which is unheard of at this point. I can't imagine anyone getting a law degree while playing on tour. But anyway, you had the perfect, I guess, combination of skills. Is that what led you to start ProServe in 1970? Because you represented Arthur Ashe then as his agent, right? So you guys' relationship continued.
No, what happened is it's a true story and very ironic. In 1969, when the Davis Cup won, and we won it twice, there was a lot of pressure on me and to retire, really. And I wanted to get out because I wanted to get out when we were undefeated. Nobody had ever done that. And secondly, the game was going pro now with the U.S. Open and the prize money events in 69. And so I decided that I would retire in January of 70. And there were a couple reasons for that, but one, I'd done it full time for 2 years, traveling everywhere with the players. Our per diem was $28 a day, plus hotel and travel. So, you know, nobody's making any money. We were all amateurs in that sense, but the game was going pro. So these people were turning pro. So in early 70, January, I opened my own law office, and I took Arthur to meet a guy named Mark McCormick, not once, but four times. And I really came and wanted him to meet Mark, to be represented by Mark and be managed by Mark. And it's an absolute true story. After we had our fourth breakfast in New York at a restaurant, Mark always wanted to meet at 8 o'clock, 7:30 in the morning. He was an early guy. Arthur was never particularly happy with that. But we always had breakfast with him. And so we left the restaurant. We were driving back in a cab on the east side of New York. And Arthur said to me, sort of angrily, in the back seat of a cab, "How many more times are you going to do that?" And I said, "Do what?" He said, "You're always taking me to meet Mark McCormick. We've gone there now three or four times." And I said, "Well, I think he should represent you. I think he'd be the best for you. And, you know, he's going to make you the most money." In 68, he signed Jean-Claude Killy. He was running the Olympics marketing and television. He had three guys named Palmer, Player, and Nicholas in the world of golf. And he was head and shoulders about everybody. And so we were driving down this east. I'll never forget. And he turns to me and says, "Why don't you do it?" And I said, "Why don't I do what?" He said, "Why don't you manage me? Why don't you be my lawyer?" I said, no, Arthur, I'm going back to Hogan and Hartson. And I'm going to be the next Clarence Darrow. I want to be a trial lawyer. I don't want to manage a lawyer." He said, "Well, you know, Donald, if you think about it, if you'd manage me, Stan would join us. And you and I and Stan, we could start a new business." I said, no, thanks a million. Great idea. You should go with McCormick. I went back to my old law firm, Hogan and Hartson, asked the senior partner what he thought of the idea of managing athletes. To my absolute shock, he said, "It's a great idea." His name was Lester Cohen, was running the firm in those days, in the 60s. Hogan and Hartson was one of the top four or five big city lawyers, law companies in Washington. And Lester turned to me and said, no, we'll give you the fifth floor of our building. We'll give you tax accountants. We'll give you secretaries. We'll give you research people. You can have the whole thing and get into sports, all sports." And I said, "What would be the name of the division?" And he said, "Hogan and Hartson, sports division." I said, "Well, let me think about it." So I thought about it for 3 or 4 weeks. And for some unknown reason, I called it and said, "I'm going to start a new thing called the Law Offices of Donald Dell. And my first two clients are going to be Arthur Ashe and Stan Smith," which they were, and which I was very lucky. And a lot of it was timing. The timing in early 70, you know, that year, the first year of 70, the game really went more and more professional. There was bigger prize money. And because I'd been the Davis Cup captain and winning for 2 years, I was really the first professional agent in tennis anywhere in the world. And I had a lot of, you know, I had a lot of foreign clients. I had Jan Kodish, you know, he won the French twice. And I had Jan Leschly. Jan Leschly was from Denmark. He went on to be the head of the International Tennis Hall of Fame years later. So I was very lucky. And really, honestly, you know, it was a lot of timing. It was wonderful, lucky timing. And then that Donald Dell Law Offices grew into Dell, Craig, Yofentress, and Benton, which was a bigger law firm in about mid-70s. And then we sort of morphed into ProServe about 76, 78, because as a law firm in those days, under the canons of ethics, you couldn't recruit, you couldn't advertise, you couldn't solicit. And so we were really hand-strapped. And of course, in the 70s, our biggest competitor was none other than Mark McCormick and IMG. And, you know, he had a head start. So he stayed in golf, and I stayed in tennis for about 5 years. We kept in our separate lanes, and then both of us crossed over. He signed labor, which was tremendous. And then I went into basketball in a big way and managed Michael Jordan for 10 years and Patrick Ewing in Washington with Pro Service. So we really both expanded. And at the height of, in the early 80s, we had 300 people around the world in 16 offices for Pro Service. And I managed ProServe for 28 years as the president and CEO. Mark had 1,000 people in about 28 offices. So he was always about, I'd say 2 times bigger than we were. But those were fun days because everything was new. Everything was unquestioned. Everything was just sort of, you did it on instinct and gut. And it was a fun, growing, challenging time.
Hi, everyone. You're listening to the Tennis.com podcast with incredible special guest Donald Dell. He's telling us about his relationships with the likes of Arthur Ashe, Bobby Kennedy, Stan Smith, Tennis Channel's Ken Solomon, and a lot more. Keep listening. I don't even know where to begin here. I can't believe you just casually mentioned Michael Jordan. Like, no big deal. One more thought on Ash. I read that he gave a speech once and he named you as one of the two people he would trust with his life along with his father. What would be your thoughts on him as a person, on Arthur Ashe?
Well, I've been very, very fortunate. You know, I managed athletes for probably 30 or 40 years. And of all the clients, we've had lots of different ones in different sports. I would say Arthur was by far the most unique. First of all, he was a speed reader, had a photographic memory, tremendous IQ, soft-spoken, quiet, but very, very curious. And the story you heard is a true one. In about 1971, Arthur was giving a speech at the Democratic Women's Club in Washington. There are 400 women, and there were three men in the whole audience. There was Arthur, his father, and me. And we went and sat at the head table. I had no idea that this was going to be, you know, 400 or 500 women and no other people. And they introduced Arthur, and when he got up to speak, he said, he was sort of being funny, and he said to the audience, he said, "I'm here with two people, my father and Donald Dell, who I would trust with my life, meaning his father, of course, and meaning me." And I was sort of stunned by what he said, and the audience was. And it was amazing because 2 days later, a lady from the audience, which nobody knows, named Mrs. Collis Jones, phoned me and said, "Could I get a copy of Arthur's speech? I was at that luncheon. I'd like to hear it again." She said, "I have a son named Collis Jones. He's an All-American basketball player at Notre Dame. And I'd like to talk to you about managing him, but I want to listen to the speech first." Then she called Collis's coach, who was Joe Gallagher at St. John's High School here in Washington. It's a tremendous athletic school, football and basketball. And Joe knew me from playing basketball at Landon. He said, "No, Donald's this, Donald's that." And the next thing I knew, my first client in basketball was Collis Jones. And he was All-American at Notre Dame for 2 years. He was drafted number one in the NBA by Milwaukee, who had just won the championship that year with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who was in Milwaukee before he went to the NBA in LA. So suddenly, because of Arthur and that speech, I got very involved in basketball in the NBA. And I did that for the next 20 years. But it was originally because of that speech that Arthur did and his comment.
It's all about who you know. It sounds like the relationships are more important than anything else. At least that's what I've come to understand here. Since we've talked about Arthur,
go ahead. Talk for a second about Arthur, because he was probably, and people always say to me, "Who is your favorite athlete?" And Stan Smith and I have been together for 47 years. Both Arthur and Stan were on a handshake. We had a letter agreement for 1 year when we started in 1970. They both had the identical same two-page letter agreement. They both expired in 71. And Arthur and I went on for 23 years on a handshake, and Stan and I are together 47 years later on a handshake. And that tells you a lot about the character of those two people. But I would say about Arthur, he was one of the strongest, quietest characters that you would ever meet. And he had very strong beliefs. And the reason for that was his father. His father was quite a guy, a phenomenal man in Richmond. He was a retired policeman, and he also worked in a place called Bird Park. And he was sort of the guy who took care of Bird Park. And it was a public park in Richmond, Virginia. But Arthur was not allowed to play tournaments in Bird Park because he was black. So when I became Davis Cup captain in 68, the very first thing I did, our first match was against the British West Indies, an all-black team. And guess where I scheduled the match? Bird Park, Richmond, Virginia. That wasn't by accident. And the place went absolutely berserk to cheer, you know, Arthur, and the crowds were tremendous. The team was not, the British West Indies was not a good team. They had a couple of good players, but they weren't, they weren't going to beat us. And that sort of started to open up a segregated park, which Arthur had lived in and grown up in.
It's remarkable that about 50 years later, these issues with, you know, not segregation, but racial inequality is still present here, especially in America. What's your take on players that are trying to stand up and use their platform and kind of try and force change in this climate? Is there any delicacy with, you know, like, I know the players have contracts and obligations and things they can and can't do. What's your take on having players that want to stand up for things like fighting for equal rights?
Well, I think it's amazing because sport in general, all sport, has become so, so popular, particularly in the American culture. Look at with no live sports now. Everybody's going crazy. ESPN's doing everything to fill content. The Last Dance by Jordan, which was 10 episodes, if you can imagine. And it had the greatest audience viewing because everybody's sort of starving for live sports. So I think that proves the point that individual sportsmen have a tremendous following now. And together, collected, I think LeBron's been very good at this and others, that you can organize and push change. I mean, it's really interesting. Take Kaepernick in the NFL. He dropped to a knee 4 years ago. I don't care what anyone says. There was an unwritten rule that nobody's going to hire him of the owners in the NFL. Well, that's all just changed last week with Goodell, the commissioner, coming on so strongly. So he's advocating to black players in NFL football to lead the way for change. For example, one of his quotes was, without black players, there would be no NFL. Well, it's very interesting. You haven't heard any NFL owners stand up and speak. You assume that Goodell is speaking for the individual owners, and I hope he is, but you're going to find out in about a month's time if anybody hires Kaepernick, because he was a hell of a talent. And there's no question that as a backup quarterback, he'd be better than half of the backups in the NFL today, in my opinion. It's just an amateur outside thought. So we'll see what happens. But to answer your specific questions, I think athletes, if they are organized, can be the biggest element of change of anybody, because they have a platform. They can stand up and talk every day and people want to cover them, you know, and they're more genuine than politicians today who are a mess. They never give you an honest answer about even who their name is or whether they're in the Republican Party or what they are. I mean, it's nonsense. So the athletes by default, because the politicians have been pathetic in stepping up, the athletes have grown in stature, and I think they could be tremendous in leading change.
Absolutely. I absolutely agree. I think it's an interesting time, to say the very least, and how things might develop from things. You know, we'd start off with WHATP merger to things like fighting for equality. There's a lot of change possible coming up. I have one last question. It's a little bit of a wild card. I want to know, you know, for people who do not know this, that you worked with Rob Kennedy in late 1960, I think 1968 to be precise. What was Rob Kennedy like? I know that it was only a brief time.
First and foremost, no one ever called him Rob. It was Robert Kennedy.
Robert.
It tells you that you're of a different generation. It was Robert Kennedy. Some people called him Bob, but never Rob. But no, I was very fortunate in 66, 67 when I was working at Hogan and Hartson. And again, I lived right across in Georgetown in an apartment. I was single. And I went over several times, met the Kennedy somehow, somewhere, and started playing tennis with him on Saturdays and Sundays. And actually really got involved trying to teach Bobby how to hit a backhand. And they loved tennis. They had their own court. And they would always invite people every Saturday and Sunday. They would have lots of people at their home out there at Hickory Hill, just across the river in Virginia. And so I spent probably a year going out there quite a lot, see them, got to know them as a family. And then Bobby decided suddenly in 68 to run for the presidency. In 66, he had run for the U.S. Senate. He had won the Senate, in, I think, 64, 65. And 66 was an off-year election. And one of his very strongest friends and greatest lieutenants was a fellow named John Nolan, who was a lawyer in Washington, number one graduate from Annapolis, tremendously strong person. He would have been attorney general, in my judgment, if Bobby had won. And John in 66 asked me to come on and make some stops for Bobby. So I advanced for Bobby in 66 when he was running an off-year election. So in 68, when he announced for the candidacy and presidency on March 17, 1968, on March 18th, I was in Los Angeles with John Nolan setting up the California delegation for Kennedy the next day. So I hit the deck running for Bobby because I knew his family so well. And he was, you know, I had to resign from working with Sarge at OEO and the Peace Corps. And Lyndon Johnson was the president, was still going to run. And so I was in California, and suddenly they called me back to Washington and asked me if I would oversee running five states as the lead advance. And my five states were Arizona, West Virginia, California, Oregon, and the District of Columbia. So I was what was called the lead advance, which meant I had 30 or 40 people reporting to me in each state. And I would move constantly from state to state in 1968. And also the only problem with that was also the Davis Cup captain in 68. So I was switching jobs back and forth, but they were really exciting, fun times. And certainly I got to know Bobby, and I had a big advantage because I could walk into any hotel and go up and see him anytime at night. And, you know, in politics, it's all about access. And people used to, you know, this thing that they said with Bill Clinton, you know, friends of Bill Clinton. Bobby was a forerunner. The Kennedy family has always been like that. They've always had close people very involved in their political campaigns. And literally, honestly and sincerely, the most exciting moment probably my entire life was not playing at Wimbledon seven times. It may not have even been winning the Davis Cup twice. We had Bobby come into Arizona and we put him in Goldwater's Plaza. Barry Goldwater had a big plaza in Phoenix, and we put in 28,000 people to see Kennedy on a Saturday. And we were doing that very deliberately because we wanted to be in that particular plaza. I was in charge of the stop. The next day, Bobby phoned me in the morning and said, would you come over and have play tennis with me out in Scottsdale? Fly back with us on the plane. I said, sure. So I went and we jumped on the plane. We flew into New York, LaGuardia. It was March 31st, 1968. We had been in the campaign for 2 weeks. And Lyndon Johnson was president, and we were fighting him everywhere. Plane landed, and I was in the front sitting next to Ethel, and she hated to fly because two of her brothers had been killed on plane crashes, so she was a nervous wreck. The guy burst through the front door, and I'm blocking the aisle. Bobby's about 3 feet from me, sitting there reading some papers. And the guy says, I got to see the senator. I said, wait, just relax. And he's a tall guy, about 6'4", bald, and he starts perspiring. Bobby's only about 3 feet from us. So after about a minute and a half, 2 minutes, the guy really, he said, damn it. He said, do you know who I am? I said, no. He said, I'm the state chairman in New York. Lyndon Johnson has just withdrawn from being president. He's not going to run again in a second campaign. I got 20,000 people out in the parking lot that want to hear from Senator Kennedy. Now will you let me through? Now, he said all that, screaming it so Bobby would hear him. So I'm blocking the aisle. So I turn to face Bobby, and there's nobody between me and him. And he's looking at some papers, and he looks up at me with those steel blue eyes, and he smiles, and he sort of nods. And in that instant, with all this happening, I said to myself, we just elected the president of the United States. And it was easily the most exciting moment in my life, because when Lyndon got out, we were going to fill that void pretty quickly. So I let, and Bobby nodded, and I let the man go by and talk to him. And I'll never forget Ethel saying to me as we were walking through the parking lot, she said, God, she said, now everybody will be back from Jack's staff. He said, you know, Kenny O'Donnell, all the guys from Boston, Massachusetts, the Irish Mafia. She said, you know, they've been sitting on the fence for 2 weeks because they didn't want to fight a president in Johnson. Now, with him out, they'll be back. And then she looked up at me and said, but we're going to always remember the people who have been with us for the first 2 weeks, not the rest of the campaign. And that's the way the Kennedys were, extremely loyal, extremely outspoken. And it was really the most thrilling moment of my life when I looked and saw Bobby, knowing Johnson was out of the race. And I really, really thought that we would elect a president. And there's no doubt in my mind, if he had lived, we would have beaten easily Herbert Humphrey in the primary, and we would have to face Nixon. And I just always believed that between Nixon and Bobby Kennedy, the volumes of people voting would have carried Kennedy, but who knows?
That's a remarkable story. I'm honored that you've shared so much with us on this episode of the podcast. I can't believe all the stuff that we've got into. I'm glad I got to sneak in Bobby Kennedy in there at the very end. I really, really, really appreciate your time. I think we've taken up enough of it. So this has been the tennis.com podcast with Donald Dell.
It's been a fun time. Thank you, Nina.
Thank you.
From the Tennis Channel Podcast Network, this has been the tennis.com podcast. Be sure to subscribe to stay caught up. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and every major listening app, as well as tennis.com/podcasts. You can also see the videos of our episodes on Tennis Channel's YouTube page and tennis.com's Facebook page. We're your hosts, Nina Pantic and Irina Falcone. We'd like to thank our team, editor and audio designer and video editor Christina Koseva, producers Alexa March and Sean O'Malley, and executive producers Shelby Coleman, Kyle Einhorn, and Andy Chu.